Hi, this is Dr. Link, and we're glad to have you back again at churchandgospel.com for our Tuesday podcast, where we're going through doctrinal issues. And in particular, Dr. Ross Parker and I have been talking about apologetics. Last week, Dr. Ed Gravely joined me. This week, it's going to be just me, but I hope it'll work out. And for those who don't know, my background is as an Old Testament professor, a PhD in biblical studies, and I kind of specialize in the latter parts of Deuteronomy. But what we're going to do today is address one particular apologetic question that emerges in conversations with unbelievers all the time. Typically, what you're going to find as you go when you talk to people about Jesus, one of the things that will become an obstacle to many is the command that you see beginning in the Torah that's acted out in the book of Joshua, where every man, woman, and child of the Canaanites must be destroyed when Israel arrives there. Now, what's interesting about this is there are many ways that Christians have dealt with this issue. I'm going to focus on two of them real quickly. One is just a quick summation of probably definitely a very popular and wonderful Christian scholar, Paul Copan, who worked with Heath Thomas, who is a professor, dean over at Oklahoma Baptist University. They have looked at this text and tried to come to it with one particular understanding. We'll talk about how they, in general, it's a quick summation, understand it. Then I'm going to walk you through what I think is my approach to it. Now, obviously, I think my approach is the better answer, but trust me, many folks would side with others on that. So let's think about the issue itself first. Let's just take a moment. In this first issue, when you start talking to people about who Jesus is, you begin to talk about how loving your God is, how gracious and compassionate He is, and then the person says, yeah, why did He kill every man, woman, and child in Jericho? Well, that's a tough question to answer. And if you read these texts, I mean, it turns your stomach. Now, one of my points is it's designed to turn your stomach. And I'll try to explain that as we go through. When you get to Joshua and you finally get to the conquest, when you get to this text, you're not supposed to go, well, I'm glad that happened. You're actually supposed to feel just the horror and the terror of what it means in this conquest. So I'm going to read to you from just the chapter 6, the actual description of the conquest. And we're going to talk about the term behind it in just a moment. So I'm going to start reading verse 15 of chapter 6 of Joshua. Then on the seventh day, they rose early at the dawning of the day and marched around the city, that's the city of Jericho, in the same manner seven times. Only on that day, unlike the others, they marched around the city seven times. At the seventh time, when the priest blew the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city." The city shall be under the ban. Now, that expression, under the ban, can also be translated devoted to destruction. And it'll be our key word that we'll focus on. The root of that is karam, but we'll talk about that in a little while. For the city shall be under the ban, or devoted to destruction. It and all that is in it belongs to the Lord only. Rahab the harlot and all who were with her in the house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban, so that you do not covet them, and take some of the things under the ban, and make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it. But all the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord. So the people shouted, and the priest blew the trumpets. And when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted with a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. They utterly destroyed, completely destroyed, devoted to destruction, placed under the ban, however you want to say that, everything in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep, and donkey with the edge of the sword. I want you to just think about the imagery there of every man, woman, and child being slaughtered, that God's army brought the blade, the sword, heavily upon the old, the strong, the weak, the young, and all points in between. And you can imagine the agony of having to run through a child. Now, that is not supposed to make you say, well, they had it coming. No, in fact, the author, as I'm going to try to show you at the end of this podcast, is really trying to awaken you to the reality of what happens when we encounter God. Now, let's talk a little bit about how some scholars deal with this. Some scholars, I mentioned Paul Capone and my friend Heath Thomas, great scholars. They've done a lot of really good work on this. Paul Capone's a philosopher, an apologist, just a fantastic Christian scholar. And when he's looked at this issue, he pulls upon several factors. But one of the things he says that I think is helpful for a lot of folks is to question whether this means exactly what we think it means. Does it mean that every man, woman, and child is put to the sword? And part of the question is, many times you'll see people's placed under the ban, and then those peoples will show up later. So they're asking a very good question. Have we really understood what devoted to destruction, placed under the ban, B-A-N, what is, have we understood that right? Why do they keep reappearing if these folks have been devoted to destruction? It's a great question. And so, in short, and this is just a quick summation, this is not a fair analysis or explanation of his view, but I think it has a lot of credibility. He questions that and he says, perhaps what you have here is, you can think about it the language of the time, an idiom of the time, that means we were going to basically go in and kick some tail. It's ancient Near Eastern trash talking is particularly the phrase that Paul Capone used when he came up here, and I appreciated that. You can read it in his books, and I think that's a very helpful explanation. Now, how would that help you in apologetics? Well, if that's right, then the amount of judgment that you're having to explain to the unbeliever, that you're having to defend, not to apologize for, apologetics is about the defense of the faith, you have a lot less to defend. You have to defend the idea that unjust people were put to death. And suddenly some of those other categories are just hyperbole. They're just exaggeration. Now, that is a possible way to read it, but I think there are actually some better biblical clues to deal with this. And it goes back again to this word that we translate under the ban or devoted to destruction. And the root of that word, it appears in a noun form and a verb form, is karam. It appears 102 times in the Old Testament. Where I want you to start thinking about this ban is, where does this ban, who is it first applied to? Upon whom? Where is it applied, and to whom is it applied? Because you feel uncomfortable. What's so bad about the Canaanites? Why do the Canaanites have to be placed under the ban? What's so special and unique about them? But what's interesting is you go back and you look at this term, the first place that it appears, where it appears in the text, is back in the book of Exodus. And it appears in Exodus chapter 22, and in our English Bibles, verse 20. Now, what is that? Exodus 22, verse 20. That is right in the middle of the initial giving of the Mosaic covenant, the Mosaic laws. And our next question was, not only where was this term first used in one of its forms, but to whom was it applied? So if you look at Exodus chapter 22, verse 20, you'll see in the midst of all these laws that connect back to the Ten Commandments, and later in Deuteronomy to the Shema, he says this, "He who sacrifices to any god, to any idol, other than to the Lord alone, shall be placed under the ban, shall be utterly destroyed." Now, this is directed at Israel. This is directed at the implication of being in the presence of God at Mount Sinai. This is embedded in the idea of the first commandment. I am the Lord your God, and you shall have no others. So that this is a particular application, a particular implication of the reality that God is God and nothing else is. What that means is that the ban was first placed upon Israel before it was placed upon the Canaanites. So the first part of the problem you diffuse is the idea, why pick on the Canaanites? And what you learn is that it's not merely the Canaanites being, for lack of a better term, picked upon. Indeed, what you have instead is that any man, woman, or child who goes into the presence of God with the love of any idol in his heart shall be utterly destroyed. You see, the ban is the implication of being in God's presence. And Israel was under that ban. And what happened? in Exodus 32. Exodus 32, 40 days after the Ten Commandments, 40 days after what they call the Day of the Assembly, when the presence of God came in a terrifying way upon Israel. 40 days of trying to keep the law, and then the 40th day they said, you know what, we don't know where Moses went. He's up on that cloud up there. So we need to make a god for Yahweh. What is that? It's an idol. And it's very important that you get this, that when Moses came down, he had to put 3,000 people to death. What did he do? He utterly devoted them to destruction. Now, as uncomfortable as that may be, what I want you to see, therefore, is that helps you to understand the conquest, the land of Canaan. Just as God was with Israel on Mount Sinai, and there was a consequence for an idol in his presence, there also is a consequence upon the Canaanites, because the presence of God is coming to them. And indeed, they too will be placed under the ban. The Canaanites, we know that God was storing up wrath against them. We saw that earlier in Genesis. They had egregious sins. They had terrible sins. They were, perhaps we would say rotten human beings, but I would say that's true for all of us. There's none of us on our own that can stand in the presence of God safely. So when you see somebody talk about that, the issue is not that the Canaanites are so bad, but that, listen, all humanity is that bad. There's not a human on his own that can stand in the presence of God safely. You say, well, then why were the Israelites alive? Well, that was what the Mosaic Covenant was providing for them, a way to be close to God and yet not be destroyed by God, not devoted to his destruction. When you saw when they disobeyed the Mosaic Covenant over and over in the Torah, you saw death, death, death. Nadab and Abihu and all the other rebellions, you saw death as the consequence. Even Moses himself was on the outside of the land, unable to go in at the end. So even Moses himself was insufficient to lead the people into the presence of God, into the promised land safely. So when you have the book of Joshua, and you come to this conquest, and you've had these specific notions, especially from Deuteronomy, saying that when you make war upon the peoples in the land, you will utterly devote them to destruction. What you see is that the land of Canaan, is the land where God is coming to dwell. And one of the consequences is wherever God is, idols flee. And if you must have a land with no idols, you must get rid of idolaters. You say, well, that didn't work out that way. That's exactly right. Because we see, even in the conquest in the book of Joshua, that Israel falls into sin and to idolatry. And at first Achan, and then later throughout Joshua and into Judges, we discover that Israel is indeed an idolatrous nation, just as the nations. And ultimately, just as God judged the Canaanites by bringing Israel upon them, God judges, all the way to in 2 Kings, he judges Israel by bringing the nations upon them. So that God is totally just, that idolatry cannot stay in his presence. Just as Adam was removed for one sin from his presence, you and I cannot enjoy his full presence with any sin in us, apart from the grace of Christ. And it is the grace of Christ that is removing all that sin, which, you know, takes you back to the discussion of salvation being not merely the moment you were saved, justification, but also sanctification as we go through life, trying to walk with God, and he shapes us into his image. And lastly, when we die, then we will be glorified with him. So I think apologetically, this is a very important notion, is that sometimes we're afraid to deal with these very difficult concepts. The good news is the biblical writers have already anticipated these concerns, and their stomachs have already been overturned at these concepts. So the writer, with great pain, is laying out the judgment of the Canaanites. Why? Because when you see Jericho judged by the word of God spoken by his people, when you see Israel take Jericho, you get a preview, an eschatological preview of the judgment that's coming everywhere. You see, when I read the text, yes, I resonate with God's people being victorious, but I also resonate with the Canaanites who are due that judgment, because I recognize that I, in my city, in my country, in this whole creation, is due the judgment that God will bring. And what I long for is a creation where there are no idols. Well, the only way that can be is if there are no idolaters. And so what you need are hearts that love God completely. And there's only one heart in this creation that loved God completely. That's the heart of Christ. But by his death and resurrection, he is circumcising hearts. And the cross is so powerful that in the end, anyone who trusts in what he did can do what? Can find life in the new heavens and new earth, which will be radically different from this earth. Why? Because there'll be no idols there. This creation is flawed because Adam as its king was flawed. But the new heavens and new earth will be perfect because Christ as its king will be made perfect. And the cross is so powerful that it can take the worst of our hearts, the idols of our hearts, and overturn them. So that's what I think you can do in apologetics and dealing with some of these tougher questions. I think the answer that other scholars give are fine, but to me they don't cut to the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter is what you see in the conquest is an implication of who God is and who we are. That points to the necessity of the cross. And so what you see starting in Jericho, indeed starting at Mount Sinai, is what will happen everywhere. So I'm a graduate of a large Southern public university for my undergraduate degree, and they have a motto there, and it says, what starts here changes the world. And what I remind folks is that what starts with the presence of God at Mount Sinai, what starts with the judgment of God upon Jericho, that's what's going everywhere. What starts there changes everything. The what's happening to the land of Canaan in the Bible is eventually what will happen to every part of the creation. Not only does the New Testament say that, the Old Testament says that. Indeed, I would argue Moses and the prophets. And you say, where will we see that? Well, notice that Isaiah, when he envisions what's coming, he says that the knowledge of God will cover the whole creation the way the waters cover the seas. So that is, to me, one of the ways that you try to deal with apologetics. You try to develop as biblical of an argument as possible, and you make sure that you're looking to the broader context. You need to involve yourself with the discussion of what other scholars have said. I've tried to demonstrate that. You need to demonstrate an understanding of the language used, the phrases used. You need a great understanding of church history and theology to help you think through that, because as you think of that issue and you begin to study church history, you will find countless approaches to it, some better than others, of course, but that's the way it works as a Christian. We can learn not only from those Christians who are alive, but those who have gone before us, and indeed, I think we should. And so as we continue our discussion of doctrine and apologetics here on our Tuesday podcast, I want to end you with this just one reminder that in Saturday, November 12th, we are actually going to be teaching Bible teachers about how to deal with the book of Joshua and these very issues. And so if you want a more detailed examination of it, if you want to prepare yourself to teach that, or just to understand Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, let me tell you, we've got a plan for you. The Epic Bible Study Teacher Training will be Saturday, November 12th. We'll be here at 8 a.m. to noon. It's free. You can come down to CSU. You can sign up at churchandgospel.com, and we would love to have you join us. So in the meantime, thank you for joining us here at churchandgospel.com on our Tuesday podcast, and hopefully Dr. Parker and I will be able to join you next week, Lord willing, and we look forward to it.